Hi, Wild Things. Last week, I learned the sad news that Jeff Meldrum had passed away after a battle with brain cancer. I interviewed him multiple times for the first season of Wild Thing, and he was incredibly generous with his time and extremely patient in answering my questions about Bigfoot. In memory of him, I've excerpted a section from one of our interviews at a 2017 conference held in honor of the 50th anniversary of the Patterson-Gimlin film. It was such a noisy venue that we had to conduct the interview in the parking lot of the hotel, sitting in my rental car in the rain. Not exactly studio conditions, so forgive the audio imperfections. I started by asking him how he'd gotten interested in Bigfoot.
Well, let's see. I mean, it's always where to start. My first exposure to Bigfoot was when I was about 11 years old in Spokane, Washington. And at that time, Roger was coming through Spokane showing his produced documentary that showcased that 60 seconds of film.
The Roger he mentioned is, of course, Roger Patterson.
So that was my first exposure to it. I had interests that waxed and waned through the years, as you know, as I was growing up. And it certainly, whether overtly or subliminally, had an influence, I think, too, on, or at least steeled some of the youthful interests I had in various topics of relating to anthropology. And I ended up in a field of anthropology that was very apropos to considering some of the most prolific evidence, the footprint evidence. And so here I was, a budding anthropologist with interests in the evolution of human bipedalism and this sort of latent interest in the possibility of relic hominoids in North America. And I'm confronted with this set of this extraordinary, quite honestly, extraordinary set of tracks in southeastern Washington. And that really set the hook. I mean, there was this long line of extremely fresh and extremely clear footprints that conveyed, especially to me, given my expertise and background, a remarkable message. The impact of it, the stark nature of that evidence was quite telling.
Yeah. And have you, aside from the footprints, have you had a sighting or any other experiences that...
A number of experiences. I've heard vocalizations that I couldn't peg. You know, I'm certainly not an expert, but I'm familiar with wildlife sounds. And it's these days with the internet, it's very easy to sample a variety of vocal repertoires for various species. I've had things entered camp under the, in this case, one of the most dramatic ones occurred not far from here in the Six Rivers National Forest, which involves something coming in under the cover of fog and brushing against the tents, rifling through the backpacks, disappearing, melting back into the fog every time we would get out of the tents to investigate. The closest thing to an actual visual encounter occurred in Alberta, Canada, and after days of hiking, there was a vocalization accompanied by the sounds of movement of something that, you know, on the order of a bull elk, the brush popping and footfalls, and it circled outside of the firelight around our camp. We could hear the brush popping, and one member of our group was bold enough to venture out into the darkness towards it, talking to it, and then at one point, there was this crack, which sounded like the breaking of a baseball bat against a tree. And I'm watching through a night vision monocular, and I could see her knees start to shake, and she retreated. That unnerved her because of the intensity of that strike, that break. She retreated back to the campfire, and at that point, I had to adjust my position because of the smoke. And as I stepped around, I caught sight of what appeared to be a shadowy figure. And in about four or five steps, it was across the road and into the opposite tree line. So it was, you know, it was better than a 50-50 chance that what I saw was it. But so I'm sorry if I'm rambling. I don't know.
No,
you want me to go for shorter answers?
Yeah,
or
shorter's fine, but it's also interesting to just hear some of the detail and
sure.
Experiences.
And then you can cut and pick.
Yeah, you had a, you know, what, 50-50 chance sighting here. Grover never had one, right?
Right. He never did.
Yeah. And can you remind me again how you met Grover?
The first time I actually had a face-to-face introduction to Grover was actually at the physical anthropology meetings, the national meetings of the American Association of Physical Anthropologists. And we, talked a little bit about Grover's interest in Sasquatch. And at that point, it was just kind of an in-the-background type of interest of mine because of my youthful history with it. And it was funny because, you know, I'm a little starstruck, you know, having read his books and particularly been fascinated by his assessment of the anatomy of the Sasquatch foot and description of his interpretation of the function of it. And I conveyed that, said that I had followed his work and, you know, admired the contributions he'd made. And got a very different response than I expected. He goes, "Why doesn't anybody recognize the other anthropological research that I do?" And I just kind of, "Oh, okay, I'm sorry," you know, and kind of walked away with my tail between my legs in a way. And so that wasn't the most auspicious first encounter. The much more positive, real first meeting, I guess you could say, where he was on his home turf.
In Pullman,
yeah. Grover was very gracious and spent several hours with me. He pulled out casts and was spreading them out. We were discussing and we were talking about repeat appearances. And I must have made an impression because he then set about to make some casts, some replicas for me from his remarkable silastic rubber molds that he had created for a number of the original material. The bulk of which now, those molds, resides in my laboratory. And he sent those home with me with the little annotation, you know, "I usually charge for these, but in your case." So I felt privileged by that. You know, that was an acknowledgement that I was a fellow researcher and not just a fan.
So do you ever have any regrets about choosing this path? I mean, did you know what you were getting yourself into?
I did. To some degree, and again, it goes back to Grover. As I was kneeling next to these tracks outside of Walla Walla, there was actually a moment when because I just had come from Grover's lab, and as I knelt there, I was fully aware of the ridicule and the grief that had been heaped upon Grover. You know, the times he was the butt of a joke about the various caricatures and so forth. I mean, it reminds me of all the political cartoons and so forth, satire of Darwin that I actually, you know, talk with my students about when I teach evolution. And I remember having that thought, that moment when I said to myself, asked myself, "Okay, do you really want to go down? You're at a fork here. Do you really want to go down this path? You know, do you want to risk? Is this what you want your career to, the direction you want your career to go?" And if the footprints had not been so stunning, so unambiguous, I might have equivocated on that decision. But my response to myself was, how could you possibly walk away from this at this point, knowing what you know? And the thought never occurred to me that, even though I was aware that that Grover had experienced some delays in his promotion to full professor, it never occurred to me that it might compromise my career in that way because I was quite naive in that respect. And like Grover, my promotion to full professor was delayed by quite a number of years. I mean, to illustrate how bad it was, the acting chair at that time, the chair of our department, had been heard to say, "Meldrum will never be promoted to full professor so long as I'm chair of this department." And it revealed a very unseemly underbelly of the academic community. Yeah. My idealism was dashed. And I don't think I've become quite as cynical. I remember reading Grover's Big Footprints, and there's that whole chapter in the back about the scientific establishment, as he called it. And I just sort of chalked it up to kind of sour grapes. But there was a level of cynicism that kind of surprised me, and that he would actually put in print. But, You know, and as I relate this experience of my own to you, I hesitate. What, you know, should I put that on, say that on the record or not? But I think it's important. I think that people understand that, you know, that ivory tower is rather, oftentimes very tarnished, and that, you know, the ideals of objective scientific, you know, free of morality, the constraints of morality, just the pure quest for knowledge, is anything but.
So, other than Grover, I mean, you are essentially one of the only academics that has taken on this, has taken Bigfoot seriously.
Right. Right. I am a bit of the lone voice crying in the wilderness, it feels at sometimes. There are others, though. I'm certainly the most visible right now. You know, I was very gratified to meet John Bindernagel. Likewise, John Myanzinski is a wildlife consultant. We've done lots and lots of field work and discussed and bounced ideas off each other extensively. But I wanted to point out that there are a lot of interactions which I have with academics behind the scenes who aren't visible so much. They have a presence through service on editorial boards, for example, of my Relicominoid Inquiry journal. You know, I've talked about the shift in paradigm. And how the attitudes, the assumptions in the scientific community are beginning to shift. Sometimes it takes an entire generation to pass away before a new paradigm can take root. And that's what we're on the cusp of experiencing. You know, a lot of the old guard, some of these investigators from the 50s, 60s, 70s are now passing away. The John Greens, the Rene de Hindens and so forth. And, well, just by way of example, we recently had a new assistant professor, and she came to discuss some of the collaborations that would involve our anatomical donation program for her research. And then at one point, she kind of sheepishly said, "Can I ask a nerdy question?" And I said, "Well, sure." And she said, reached into her satchel, said, "Would you sign my copy of your book?" And I was delighted. Here was a recent graduate from a high-profile university program in anthropology who was fascinated with this subject. And so that's, I think that we'll see more and more and more of that.
That was Jeff Meldrum speaking with me at a conference in 2017. Dr. Meldrum was a professor of anatomy and anthropology at Idaho State University, where he taught since 1993. He passed away on September 10th, 2025.